Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. At this time, I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Candace, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop update on chronic lymphocytic leukemia. And today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations and many other blood cancer organizations. And it really is because of that collaboration that we have so many of you on the call today. And also because of your interest in the program and our wonderful speakers, actually, a lot of reasons that you're all on the call. And we have over 660 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, China, Germany, India, Serbia, and the United Kingdom. So it's really a credit to all of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. Now, today's program was supported by an educational grant from Janssen Biotech, Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs, LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of this very important program. And it's a program that I know many of you are most eager to hear about, and we have wonderful speakers on our program today. And I want to begin by introducing our first speaker, and our first speaker is Dr. John Pagel. Dr. Pagel is Chief of Hematologic Malignancies Program, Director of Stem Cell Transplantation, Swedish Cancer Institute, Seattle, Washington. And Dr. Pagel is going to address overview of chronic lymphocytic leukemia, or CLL, current treatment options, and clinical trial updates. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Pagel.
Well, great. Thank you, Carolyn. It's nice to be with everybody on the call. It's a true pleasure in that regard. It's also an honor for me to be able to be on the call with Dr. Brown. And I hope that this is a nice event over the next hour or less talking about CLL. And I will say that I'm here in Seattle, just believe it or not, for those people who are wondering, it's not raining. It's actually blue sky somewhat, but that probably will change here in just a few minutes. I'm here to talk about CLL and give a little bit of an overview of it as we get started. We will touch on the general basics that many people might already know who are on the call, but of course I'm sure there's many people on the call who are relatively new to the topic of CLL, and that'll be important for them. We'll talk a little about the approaches to treating patients, the general approaches here in 2016, and then lead that over to Dr. Brown and give a little more in-depth discussion perhaps of some of the things I'll touch on here. So just as a big overview, I think it's important to note that just like you can get a cancer of any cell in your body, a breast cancer, a colon cancer, prostate cancer, you can get cancer of blood cells. Blood just happens to be in a liquid form. It's a liquid organ. And you can get a cancer in any of those blood cells. Most often this happens in white blood cells. And in particular, it most often happens in a white blood cell we call a lymphocyte. Now, we all have lymphocytes that are normal. They're usually born in the bone marrow, our lymphatic tissue. They grow up. They have a normal job to do. The lymphocyte's job is to become an antibody-producing cell. And we use those antibodies, as everybody knows, typically to fight infections or invading organisms. And then those cells, after they've done their job, they become adults, parents, grandparents, and now they die. And that's a normal lifespan of a lymphocyte, but something, of course, in that process of maturation of those cells can go wrong. And when something goes wrong there, it may not be repaired, and those cells end up making too many of themselves. They become what we call a clone of themselves. You can think of those white stormtroopers in Star Wars. They were all clones of themselves. And so all of these cells are the same, and they actually also have another problem is not only do they make more of themselves, but they don't die. And so that's why these cells like to grow and divide and actually increase in numbers. So they may come out of the bone marrow. They may circulate in the blood. These cells circulating in the blood is why we call this leukemia. Circulating malignant cells is the definition of leukemia in the blood. And sometimes they like to hang out and live in lymph nodes or lymphatic tissue. So we know sometimes lymph nodes can get a little big in that regard, maybe even in the spleen, or rarely but less common, the liver as well. So that's a big overview of leukemia, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, lymphocytic because of the lymphoid cell line or the lymphocytes being the cell of origin. And this is what we call a chronic disease. This is not acute. So people might have this for years before they even know they have the disease. And in fact, people will live for many years. In fact, perhaps even decades with the disease. And we've certainly made major progress in changing the natural history of the disease. And we'll talk a little about those approaches as we move forward here. So someone might typically go to their primary care physician for a routine evaluation, a checkup, a physical exam. They get a blood count, and their white blood cell count's a little high, and in particular, the certain white blood cell that's a little high is something we call the lymphocyte. Again, that is the cell that's the CLL cell. And that leads to a series of tests that are commonly done now, in particular, something you may have learned called flow cytometry in particular that can give us what we call the immunophenotype of that type of cell that's too large in number. Immunophenotype really is just the markers. It tells us what the hair color is of the cells or what the eye color is. And certain cells, like CLL cells, have a certain hair color or a certain eye color. So those are the mechanisms that we use to determine if this is CLL that's circulating in the blood. And most people will present in an asymptomatic fashion. This is a very common finding, that people feel perfectly fine and they are told that they might have CLL. It is true that some people can present with symptoms. That may be things like night sweats, and we're talking about drenching night sweats, ones where you have to change the sheets or your pajamas. We're also occasionally you might see some weight loss that's related to the disease or fevers. But those are relatively uncommon. Sometimes people might notice a lymph node that leads to a biopsy or further workup. Again, a definition of chronic lymphocytic leukemia. So people have now received a diagnosis perhaps of CLL, and the next thing to do is to figure out how aggressive this CLL may be and what the probable prognostic natural history of that individual patient's CLL might be. And we do a lot of tests to help figure that out. But in general, one of the most important things that we do is we like to look at what the chromosomes look like. And in particular, we do a test called fluorescence in situ hybridization that's commonly discussed. It's also known as a FISH test. And those tests really help us figure out where the underlying genetic abnormalities are that might be important for understanding how the disease is going to behave. And we pay particular attention to a couple of factors that are very important with regard to the FISH test or to the what the chromosomes look like. And we look for any abnormalities in two particular chromosomes. One is chromosome 17 and the other is chromosome 11. Of course, we're paying attention to all the others. And we also want to make sure that there's not a very high number of mutations or abnormalities in multiple different chromosomal locations or aberrations. And those things really help us figure out how aggressive we need to be and what treatments we need to use for each individual patient. And I'll touch a little bit more on those higher risk features, like a change in chromosome 17. We call that a deletion of the short arm of chromosome 17 or a 17p deletion. Same thing we might see with the longer arm of chromosome 11, 11q deletion. And again, I've already mentioned multiple abnormalities, something we might call a complex cytogenetic change, or we use the term karyotype, meaning what the chromosomes look like. And we use all that information to provide some prognostic information for each individual patient. That information and a variety of other things, and I would say that if you're with CLL, those are things that you want to talk to your doctor about, because each patient has a different genetic profile or features that will prognosticate how we believe their disease will behave. We take all that information and we figure out what we're going to do. But if patients are asymptomatic, don't have problems, they feel perfectly fine, there are no red flags, so to speak, then we just watch patients. We don't do anything. And in fact, I have a patient in my clinic who's had this disease for more than 20 years and never even been treated. That's unusual. People usually do need treatment, but it's very common to do what we call watch and wait. So we'll watch people for a significant amount of time until there's a reason to get treatment. Why do we do that? Well, to date, we don't have any evidence to say that if we treat patients when they're asymptomatic, meaning not having any symptoms, that that will actually change how long they're going to live. And that's with some caveats. Those trials that looked at those kinds of questions are relatively old. And so getting treatment when you don't need it is not what we do, unless it's part of a clinical trial. And we might touch on those later in this talk or in this call. So we'll watch and wait patients until there's a reason for treatment. And those reasons can be some of the things we've mentioned. You're having symptoms, maybe lymph nodes or a spleen are getting too big, causing discomfort or pain. Sometimes we actually might see the lymphocyte count or the white blood cell count doubling or moving up too fast. And in fact, if the lymphocytes are doubling at a rate of 6 months or less, that's usually an indication that we probably want to get on top of the disease by treating it. And then sometimes what happens is that these cells like to grow in the bone marrow, and they may affect other types of cells that are also made in the bone marrow. So sometimes people can become anemic, or their platelets can go down, something we call thrombocytopenic. And those are also reasons for treatment. So we watch people. If there's a reason for treatment, we do that. And then the big thing that's very individualizes how we treat patients has become more specialized in that it's patient-centered focus based on what we think is appropriate for each individual patient. And we break patients down into essentially three major groups. There are patients who we describe as very fit. They may be a little bit younger, and that's, of course, a relative term. Those are patients that have now been kind of termed the go-go patients. They're patients we think could tolerate standard, what we call cytotoxic chemotherapy, and I'll touch on that in a second. Another group is the no-go patients. Those are patients that are very unfit, perhaps, bedbound in some ways, or extremely elderly, and therapy might be extremely difficult for them. And so those are people that we might provide just a supportive care approach or measures to. I will say there are very few of those patients. With the drugs we have and the approaches we have, there are very, very few patients that we can't treat and help. And there's a middle group. Between the go-go patients and the no-go patients, there's a what we call a slow-go patients. They may be patients we think can tolerate treatment. They may be a little bit unfit. They may be a little bit older. Again, a relative term. I think that's important. But there are also patients that we don't think are going to tolerate full-blown standard chemotherapy. So what do we do for the standard patient who we call a go-go patient, a patient that's fit? Maybe this is a patient who's 60 years old, maybe even 65. These are people that we think can tolerate good aggressive treatment. And in 2016, the standard of care for those patients is still to give what we call cytotoxic chemotherapy. And in the United States, we use two major regimens. One is a regimen you may have heard of called FCR, and another one is called BR. FCR is fludarabine, Cytoxan, and Rituxan. BR is bendamustine and Rituxan. Both good regimens. They're delivered as outpatients. They're usually very well tolerated and can have major positive effects in controlling the disease for most every patient. In fact, we do know that there's a subset of patients who get FCR and the upfront treatment when they need therapy who may actually have extremely long survivals, well more than a decade, and those are people that we're wondering if we're even curing with FCR therapy. Who are those patients? Well, they're the best risk patients that we can see. So they've got the most favorable chromosomes, and they have other genetic features that are highly favorable. And there are a lot of those patients out there. And so FCR, or perhaps in an older patient who's fit, BR, are very appropriate standards for go-go patients. The slow-go patients, we typically might think of something that would be better tolerated. And more recently, a drug called ibrutinib has been approved, which is very reasonable for those patients. You'll hear more about ibrutinib from Dr. Brown, but this is a targeted small molecule that's delivered in a pill form, very well tolerated, and it's really changed, been a game changer, a paradigm shift for us of how we actually treat these patients. It's very well tolerated and can control disease and provide a major benefit for them. And that's something very popular, even in the frontline setting, for patients who we call slow go. Again, perhaps a little bit more unfit that we don't want to give standard chemotherapy to. Now, I will say that you can give ibrutinib to really any patient up front, even those patients who are more fit, and we're learning more about how to do that in that upfront setting for those patients. Fortunately, we're collecting more data and following people for longer periods of time, and we'll know where that falls out as we move forward. I do want to point out, though, that not every patient falls into those treatment categories, and that may be because they have more aggressive genetic features that require us to treat them differently. And in particular, if patients have a deletion of the short arm of chromosome 17 called a 17p deletion, those patients should definitely get one of the newer targeted treatments. And in the upfront setting, that should be ibrutinib. So if you have a 17p deletion, typically the first treatment is ibrutinib and not standard chemotherapy. Well, what happens when people relapse? Because they will relapse. Most people do. Hopefully you have a remission of years, and then the white count starts trickling back up, and so people need some treatment again. And by the way, that pattern of treatment off and on can go on for years and years and years, maybe decades, and people can do very, very well. But when people do relapse, they have lots of choices. Sometimes we deliver more chemotherapy. Sometimes we actually might deliver for them a newer other series of drugs. And there's another one that's important to know about known as idelalisib, also a small oral pill form of targeted treatment that's been also a changer for how we treat these patients. Now, you'll hear more about the side effects of these drugs, but these have been important players in how we treat patients. Also, I will say that there's lots of new drugs coming, and Dr. Brown will tell you about those that may be significant improvements over the drugs that I've just mentioned. I should have mentioned also another regimen that's important to always think about in patients who might be a little bit older with CLL and reasonable to talk about with your doctor, and that's a regimen that's been pioneered by the German CLL study group, and that's a regimen of Gazyva or obinutuzumab, an anti-CD20 antibody like Rituxan that everybody knows, in combination with an oral form of chemotherapy called chlorambucil. And that's a regimen that's usually extremely well tolerated, that's also very reasonable in the slow-go patients. Well, I suspect I've kind of probably gone over my limit a little bit, but I'm going to summarize where we're at with regard to an overview and treatment options. CLL is a disease that people can do extremely well with. Most everybody does. And we have good options for everybody. Some of them are potentially even curative with chemotherapy like FCR in very good risk patients. And for those patients who have less than good risk or might be unfit, there's many options, including ibrutinib and in the relapse setting, idelalisib. And a lot of clinical trials, which we'll touch on, and I'll leave to Jennifer perhaps, are ongoing to make even further strides to improving and changing the natural history of patients who have CLL. So, Carolyn, I'll look forward to having questions, but I hope that was a good start to our talk.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Pagel. That was a wonderful start to our talk, actually. Very comprehensive and also very understandable and really in language that people can understand. So I really appreciate that. I think our audience, our participants particularly, appreciate that as well. And so thank you. And our next speaker is Dr. Jennifer Brown. Dr. Brown is Director, Chronic Lymphocytic Leukemia Center, Senior Physician, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, Associate Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Boston, Massachusetts. And Dr. Brown is going to address new and emerging treatment updates, tips to manage complications and side effects, and communicating with the health care team about quality of life concerns. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Brown.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. It's really a pleasure to be here with you and Dr. Pagel, who just did a spectacular job introducing and going over the basics of CLL. I'm going to focus a little bit more on some of the newer treatments that have emerged in the last few years, and I think we really can't emphasize enough how these have really transformed the landscape for all of our CLL patients, and they're continuing to, and it's just an incredibly exciting time to be taking care of CLL patients and to have all these great new options to offer for people. And as Dr. Pagel said, these new treatments are pills, actually, which is very nice, and they're targeted drugs. So rather than having some of the nonspecific chemotherapy-type side effects where the blood counts drop and cause a lot of fatigue, they tend to have a much more specific effect on the CLL cells, and they each have a somewhat unique side effect profile, which we'll talk about a little bit later. But the leading new drug that's really been transformative, as you heard from Dr. Pagel, is ibrutinib. And this is really a drug that is now available essentially to any CLL patient, you know, in terms of the extent of its approval. And we especially emphasize it for frontline use for the higher risk disease like the 17p deletion, like you heard from Dr. Pagel, or for older patients. But pretty much most patients with CLL will likely get ibrutinib at some point. And it's really very well tolerated. It controls the disease very, very effectively for very extended periods of time. We don't even know how long because most people are still in remission who got it even very, very early on. And so that's really a very exciting thing. One thing to know about if you do start ibrutinib, though, it causes a different effect on the CLL cells initially than we see with chemotherapy, for example. With chemotherapy, we expect the white count to go down immediately and the lymphs to go down immediately. And that is what we like to see, and it's very reassuring. Ibrutinib, as well as some of the other drugs that we'll talk about, like alpelisib, actually causes a different kind of pattern of response initially, and need to be aware of it so that it doesn't seem scary, because it actually makes the lymphocyte count go up initially. But this is not the disease getting worse. It's just the cells coming out of the lymph nodes and the bone marrow and the spleen into the blood, because the ibrutinib blocks the signals that keep them in those places where they like to grow and divide and generally do things we don't want them to do. So the ibrutinib blocks that and brings them out into the blood where they die more quickly. And so initially, we'll see the white count go up for maybe a couple of months even. Or if the ibrutinib is stopped for some reason, like if you have to have a surgical procedure, we stop it for a short time, the white count can go back down, and then you restart, it'll go back up. But it usually will peak after a month or two, and then it'll start to come down, and it will go down to normal over time in most people. But even though the lymphocyte count goes up, people feel better immediately and the lymph nodes shrink immediately. And so you can see that when the drug is started right away and you know that there's nothing concerning about the lymphocyte count going up. So it's just something to be aware of. And some of the new information we have with ibrutinib actually has helped us understand a little bit better how response works in different subgroups of patients. And so we're learning more and more about that, which is great. And that will allow us to sort of improve on it, develop combination therapies for patients for whom combinations would be better, or some people would be better off just staying on ibrutinib. And that's where we're looking with the future with ibrutinib. There are also some other new drugs coming along that actually hit the same target as ibrutinib that are still in clinical development, still in clinical trials, so not yet approved, but they seem to have even fewer of the side effects that ibrutinib has, which we'll go over in a minute, which is, again, just very encouraging for the future. One of the other very recent updates that I wanted to talk to you about is that just a couple of months ago, the FDA approved a new drug for CLL, and this is a somewhat different targeted drug than ibrutinib. It's still a targeted drug, but it hits a different kind of target. And for example, this one does actually make the white count go down initially rather than up, so it's somewhat distinct. And this one's called venetoclax or Vinclexta. And this initial approval that it received is for a pretty limited subgroup of CLL patients who've relapsed after prior therapy and have that high-risk FISH marker that Dr. Pagel told you about, called the 17P, or loss of the short arm of 17P. But we expect that the approval for venetoclax will probably be broadened to most relapsed CLL patients fairly soon, in probably a year or two. The clinical trials to do that have already completed enrollment. And so venetoclax has actually very exciting also, just like ibrutinib. It's actually such a potent drug that its main side effect is that it actually can kill the CLL cells a little bit too quickly. And sometimes this releases substances from the cells, which can potentially be dangerous. And so when the drug is started, we have to monitor people very closely for this problem, which is called tumor lysis syndrome. And we generally encourage drinking a lot of fluids. We sometimes give intravenous fluids. Sometimes people will even have to be admitted to the hospital to start the drug. But even if not admitted to the hospital, we'll have to come into the clinic for multiple days in the initial phases. But once you get through that first 4 or 5 week period of starting the drug, it's really very, very well tolerated. And a little bit different from ibrutinib, as I said, it drops the white count. It clears out the bone marrow very quickly. Ibrutinib will shrink the lymph nodes very quickly, but not clear the bone marrow quite as quickly. And so venetoclax will clear the bone marrow very quickly. And that actually has allowed, instead of the continuous therapy that we do with ibrutinib, some people to stop venetoclax and still maintain their response even after stopping it. And so it provides a somewhat different approach to treatment, a little bit more perhaps like with the chemotherapy where you do it for a defined period and you may be able to stop. Now, we don't do that standardly yet with venetoclax. It's still mostly given continuously, but this is sort of part of the future. One of the things that I think we're very interested in studying is the potential that we can perhaps shorten some of the treatment with these novel drugs so that people don't have to be on them indefinitely. And there's a lot of excitement about combinations, combining venetoclax with ibrutinib, for example. And then the other targeted drug that you heard from Dr. Pagel is called adelalisib. And that one hits a different target, but in the same pathway as ibrutinib. So it causes the same thing with the white count going up initially and then dropping over time while the nodes shrink early on. And we do tend to reserve that for later than ibrutinib. It has been approved for patients who actually are in that slower go category, who are perhaps older or have some medical problems. So it is pretty well tolerated usually in people who've had prior therapies, but again, it has a characteristic side effect profile. And there are other drugs also hitting this target that are coming along that are in clinical trials in what we call a registration trial, where when it's done, it will lead to a new approval by the FDA, hopefully, if the drug shows the benefit that we think. And the drug there that is most advanced is called duvelisib. And like the acalabrutinib, which is sort of the next generation version of ibrutinib, both of these look like they maintain the effectiveness, maybe even more effective, we don't really know yet, but hopefully with fewer side effects. But again, the side effect profile of these drugs is really pretty favorable when we compare it to chemotherapy, because in general they often make people feel much better quickly without causing, for example, some of the fatigue that we do see often with chemotherapy, especially over time. Our chemotherapies, though, the FCR or the chlorambucil obinutuzumab, don't cause what you may think of typically with hair loss, for example, or severe nausea. They're usually pretty well tolerated. We don't get hair loss. Nausea, if it's there, is usually pretty easy to manage. But they do cause fatigue, and they do lower the blood counts, so there's a risk of getting a fever. And, you know, anytime you're on any treatment, if you get a fever, that's something that you want to bring to the attention of your healthcare team, because that could signal that there could be an infection that we want to know about and that we want to treat. And that would apply even to the ibrutinib and the adelalisib. So what then are some of the specific side effects of these new drugs? So ibrutinib, when it's first started, can sometimes cause some diarrhea. It's usually not terribly severe diarrhea. It usually can be managed with drugs like Imodium to just help calm it down. And in many people, it goes away over time. And so it's what we call self-limited, usually relatively early in the therapy. Occasional people will have some nausea or some more upper stomach upset with ibrutinib, but that's, again, relatively rare. And we do have a lot of anti-nausea medicines, antacids, et cetera, that we can help people with to get through that. And much of it often abates after you've been on the drug for a month or two or so. Another thing that we really notice is that people do have some easy bruising, and sometimes if you cut yourself, it'll be a little delayed in healing in ibrutinib. And this is because ibrutinib probably affects the cells that help clot the blood, the so-called platelets, a bit, and it impairs their function a bit. It's still generally okay to take ibrutinib if you're on aspirin or if you need to take some ibuprofen. We have a pretty good experience with that. In terms of using stronger blood thinners, we always evaluate that on a case-by-case basis, and we do sometimes try to avoid that if we can, but we do sometimes also use the blood thinners with ibrutinib, depending on the situation. And I mentioned earlier that if you're having a surgical procedure and you're on ibrutinib, we like to stop the ibrutinib for a short time, somewhere between 3 and 7 days usually, depending on how significant the surgery is. A couple other side effects of ibrutinib can happen either at the beginning or over time. We do see a certain incidence of a heart rhythm called atrial fibrillation, which is not terribly dangerous. It's usually readily managed, but we do see it in perhaps 5 to 9% of people who've received ibrutinib in clinical trials. This is something that's quite common in people in general in the population, and so it can be hard to tell for sure if it's related to the ibrutinib or not, but it has seemed to be a little bit more common in people on ibrutinib, and so that's something to be aware of. Over time, we have also seen some new situations of high blood pressure that need to be managed. In terms of symptoms, a couple of things that people report a lot to me on the ibrutinib that are somewhat irritating are leg swelling, and we do tend to see this over time, and you know, usually recommend keeping legs elevated if possible, perhaps trying compression stockings. If it's really annoying, we do have medicines that can sometimes help with this. And then another thing that people notice is some joint pain, muscle or joint pain. And this can happen early, it can happen late, it can happen for a few days and go away, it can happen and stay for a while. And so it's somewhat unpredictable. It can respond to Tylenol or ibuprofen, or if it's very bad, sometimes we use a short course of steroids, and then that can help as well. Venetoclax, I already mentioned that the main side effect of it can be the tumor cells dying too quickly early on, and that's something that your medical team would very closely monitor you for. There can be a little bit of diarrhea with venetoclax. That has not been very prominent in my experience treating people with venetoclax. And there can be some counts. The normal white blood cells can go down a bit, and again, that needs to be monitored. And if you do get a fever, you always want to report that to your healthcare team. With alpelisib, we see a somewhat distinct profile of side effects, and the most important one is probably diarrhea. And unlike what we see with ibrutinib, where this is early on and tends to go away, with alpelisib it tends to happen later, after you may have been on the drug for 6 months, a year, a year and a half. But it is still, if it happens later like that and is fairly significant, it is often drug-related, and it's important to really let your healthcare team know about that very quickly if it happens, because we like to hold the drug and we can tamp it down if we catch it early better than if it gets more full-blown. And we have strategies for managing that over time and potentially keeping on alpelisib. There can be some abnormalities of liver tests, but generally these don't cause people any symptoms. And then recently there's been a little bit of new information about infections on alpelisib, which we know is a fairly common thing in people with CLL in general, and particularly where you've had some prior treatments. But with alpha-adenylated that was associated with lower blood counts that may have led to infections, and some of them were relatively more severe than we might have been expecting. And so it's important, again, to be monitored for your blood counts, and if you do get a fever, to let your team know on any of these therapies. Now, that's a long laundry list of some of the sort of detailed side effects of these new targeted drugs, but it's really important to remember that the upshot of it is that they're mostly very well tolerated and people feel great, and it's almost like taking a pill for your high blood pressure. You can take a pill for your CLL and just keep it at bay for extended periods. And so this has really been transformative and is very exciting. I would stress, though, that if you do get any side effects from any treatment or anything that's bothering you in general, please do tell your medical team. We really do want to know. We want to do our best to help you. We don't always know what the cause may be, or we may not necessarily know if it's associated with the drug, but we can work with you to try and manage it or to try and alleviate it to the best of our ability. So, in summary, I would say that the treatment landscape of CLL has been absolutely transformed in the last few years with a number of new oral targeted drugs, ibrutinib, venetoclax, alpelisib, that we're continuing to do a lot of exciting research to figure out how best to use these for different subgroups of CLL patients, in what order to use them, and continuing to see actually amazing results over long-term follow-up in people who are receiving these drugs. And so it's really a very encouraging time, and clinical trials are ongoing with new combinations, with next-generation drugs that are improving based on what we know about the first-generation ones, getting rid of some of the side effects and making them better tolerated for patients. So it's very exciting. Carolyn?
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Brown. That was really excellent. Thank you so much. That was really an outstanding presentation, and also just the way you've really normalized it for people in terms of that with many of the targeted agents, and but the importance of their keeping in touch with their healthcare team. So that's so important. So I want to thank you. And I do want to say a few words before we take questions. I want you to kind of, everyone to start thinking of their questions. But before we take questions, I do want to say a few words about the free psychosocial support programs at Cancer Care and our support groups as well. So Cancer Care is a program that many of you may know about, but it's an organization that offers free oncology social work services to people living with all blood cancers, all cancers actually, and so that with the services we offer practical and financial assistance for one thing. We offer we have a co-payment assistance program. We also offer counseling services, which means you have a chance to speak with a professional oncology trained social worker to discuss your concerns or questions, you can talk with them individually on the phone, or you can also participate in one of our telephone or online support groups. And we also have, of course, these workshops, and we have many publications that you can access as well. Perhaps most importantly, people often feel like they have to cope with all of this by themselves. Now, you have your healthcare team, your physician, your own healthcare team where you are, but sometimes people feel like they need some additional support, either to talk with an oncology social worker, which there may be one in your setting, but if not, you can contact us at Cancer Care. And also may wish to be in a support group where they're with other people who actually have similar concerns and can actually kind of trade ideas and thoughts with each other. And those groups are all professionally moderated. So you don't have to do this all by yourself, and that's really an important takeaway as well from a program like this today. And now we do have time for questions. We have lots of time for questions. I'm going to ask Candace to explain to our audience how to queue up for questions, and we're going to try to take as many of your questions as possible. And if we don't get to your question and you think of a question after the program ends, I'll explain to you at the end of the program how you can go ahead and get those questions answered. But for now, let's see how many of your questions we can take. So, Candace, if you could bring all our speakers on board and explain to everybody how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star and then the number one key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question. And our first question comes from Sue P. Your line is now open.
Hello. Good afternoon. I'm wondering if anyone might be able to speak to what seems to be an adverse effect on leukemia from exposure to electromagnetic fields.
So thank you for that question. I think it's a question that sometimes people raise up in many of our different programs, I have to say. So I'm going to ask either Dr. Pago or Dr. Brown if you'd like to address it in a general way in terms of this coming up a lot.
John Pago. Let me ask Sue if she could tell us a little more about specifically her question and what leads her to ask that question. That might help us answer it.
Do
we lose her?
Oh, no, we can bring her right back. So, Candace, can you just be open to Sue's line?
So your line is now open.
Okay, thank you. I noticed that if I go someplace, especially around fluorescent lights, computers, even cars, that I end up not being able to sleep well for a couple of nights, and my infections flare up, and I'm wondering whether that's just unique to me, or if there is something that's more common about that, and if so, and if anyone has noticed it, is there anything to be done about it besides being homebound?
I'll take a stab at this. I'll let Dr. Brown chime in if she wants. You know, one of the problems that we have, not just in CLL, but in most parts of medicine, is that it's very hard to study things like this, and it's very hard to study its impact, actually, in large populations of people in particular. Lots of times we'll get questions along these types of lines about, well, what can we do with our diet, for instance, or what should I be eating, or what kind of special water is there to drink, or those things. And the somewhat unsatisfying answer to many of these things, and I think in this regard as well, is we just don't have data to know if any of these things are actually really particularly meaningful. That's not to say that it's not. We just have extreme difficulty studying these types of things. And the reason we do is because you have to really be able to look at and ask questions in large populations of people and deduce specific statistical conclusions. And as you know, that's not always easy to do in this kind of setting. So I'm not aware of any data around the issue that you're discussing, maybe, again, because it just hasn't been explored or because we just can't easily do it. But without data, it's very hard to really know exactly what the impact is. And it suggests to me that maybe this is something individualized for you that you need to work closely with your doctor with. But I haven't heard that. I would be happy to hear what Dr. Brown has to say. But I'm hoping that that's something that gets better for you, of course.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Pagel. And we do hope it gets better for you, Sue. And Dr. Brown, would you want to comment on this as well?
I agree completely with Dr. Pagel. And I'll just say that it can be very frustrating for us, these questions about diet, exercise, lifestyle, supplements, and not being able to have good answers about what people can do in those regards to sort of help them feel better, but it's just very hard to study, as he noted.
And, you know, it is an excellent point, and I think, Sue, your question is an excellent one. I mean, some of the things that about the fluorescent light and things like that, light in general, is that something can that be connected to any sort of medication or anything like that? I'm just asking that question just because it does come up in some of our other calls. So the sensitivity to light, is that something that
is it related to the medication? Is that what
is that possible or related to anything about the medication for CLL, the treatment for CLL, light sensitivity?
Well, I guess I'll just say it is true that some drugs can affect light sensitivity. Different ways that can happen. You know, I would say ibrutinib does cause occasionally some very rare eye changes, usually dry eyes, but you can have a little inflammation, and that can maybe make people sensitive to light. There's certainly always possibilities for unusual things that happen in individual patients, and I think that's certainly light sensitivity is something that we will hear about, not frequently, but it is something that we do hear about from patients.
Thank you. And so, Sue, we would suggest that, as the doctor, both Dr. Brown and Dr. Pagel have suggested, we do recommend that you go back to your treating healthcare team and identify the symptoms that you have and perhaps see if those have anything to do with any of your medicines you're taking, either for your CLL or for any other health. So many people have CLL. They may also have what we call health-related problems as well. I know that comes up in a lot of our programs. And so that's really important, a good question, actually, and a good question to go back to your treating team with. But thank you for raising it, because I suspect that I think both of our speakers have alluded to many people ask these questions, and they are really most importantly answered by your treating healthcare team. But good to check things out here. We always do appreciate that. So we do have quite a few of online questions here. So I'm going to just... Let's start with from the first question that came in. So one of them is how close are we to approval of vaccine use as part of Moonshot Project? Any update? Dr. Pagel, could you address that one?
Well, you know, vaccines are still being explored, but unfortunately vaccines have largely been unsuccessful in most blood cancers and cancer in general. I think we do, however, understand, though, that it's not necessarily just a vaccine. It's perhaps more better ways to use the immune system. Really, of course, remember that any cancer, and CLL is no different, is in some way a failure of the immune system. And when things go bad, we need to get the immune system to work better again. One strategy has been vaccinations or development of vaccines. They've largely been, as I've said, disappointing, and I don't think that there's large efforts for vaccine development in CLL at this time. But there are other therapies, what we call immunotherapies or immune-based therapies, that are very promising and exciting. Dr. Brown may want to comment a little more on them, but basically these are mechanisms to make our own immune system, again, work in a better way. And in some ways it's to either take the brakes off of our immune system so our immune system cells can actually do their job, or even to trick our immune system into recognizing CLL. And those strategies have been very promising. Those are strategies that are already in wide use for patients with melanoma, skin cancer, or with lung cancer, and in particular other types of blood cancers like Hodgkin lymphoma. And so we're doing a lot of immunotherapies or therapies around the immune system, but not specifically with vaccine therapy at this time.
Excellent. And Dr. Brown, did you want to comment as well? Or?
No, I think that covers it very nicely.
Okay, excellent. Thank you.
Sorry, Jennifer, I didn't mean to.
No problem at all.
We're always checking back. And I have a question for this question from Craig. I have been taking abutarode for two and a half years, 4 months. After starting this drug, I began to experience a rapid, irregular heartbeat. Trying various drugs to control this heart has led to a number of side effect problems. A procedure called heart ablation has been recommended, but I'm very hesitant to have it done. My question is to learn if there is some history of experience to suggest that if I cut my dose of oral cancer drug from 3 to 2 pills per day, I might be able to maintain the good progress I have made keeping my CLL in check and also eliminate my problem with atrial flutter. So actually, Craig, thank you for that question, and I'll ask our speakers to address it in a general way, and then, of course, we'll have you go back to treating healthcare team. Dr. Brown, do you want to start with that question?
Sure. The drug was ibrutinib, right? Yeah. I didn't quite catch.
Yes.
Okay. So I did mention that atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter is a side effect that we do see, unfortunately, with ibrutinib, and we usually involve cardiology and evaluate it and get recommendations on the best way to proceed in that setting, but we do usually continue the ibrutinib. There's not specific data for atrial fibrillation as to whether going down to 2 pills versus 3 would necessarily help. For some of the symptoms like the joint pain and the leg swelling and the diarrhea, sometimes those can improve going down to 2 pills rather than 3. We always worry a little bit about this because ibrutinib has to completely inhibit its target, and we know that 3 pills does that very well in the majority of patients. We don't know quite as well for 2 pills, although probably for many people 2 pills is enough to maintain inhibiting the target. And so we're still collecting data on the impact of taking 2 pills rather than 3, for example. And there has been some recent data suggesting that people continued to do very well if they were on 2 pills rather than 3, but it was a relatively small study. And so, you know, as with everything, there's sort of a balancing act that everyone should discuss with their healthcare team between the side effect and how much it's bothering you versus the CLL and whether a trial of a lower dose of the target of the drug might help or not. And there's not yet, again, this is where some of our data gaps are because the drugs are still so new that we don't know for sure. And sometimes a trial to see if it helps with side effects could be worthwhile and with active evaluation. But for atrial fibrillation in particular, there's not specific information, unfortunately, yet. But I think we will probably learn more about this over time.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we have another question. This is for Dr. Pagel. What are the treatment options for chronic lymphocytic leukemia in advanced stages? If you could address this in a general way, and then we'll ask our participant to go back to their healthcare team.
Well, you know, of course, it's a little bit of a difficult question because advanced can mean a lot of different things. Advanced, I think, probably in this setting is suggestive of maybe receive multiple different treatment options and maybe different treatment encounters. So maybe it's people that have had 3 or 4 or even more sometimes different treatments. So maybe they've had the standard chemotherapies. We've talked a lot about them. We've talked about ibrutinib, idelalisib, venetoclax, and those things. So if it's advanced in that regard, if that's what we're talking about, I think the most important thing and the first thing to think about is being involved with a clinical trial. Clinical trials are extremely important, and it's extremely important to understand that clinical trials in oncology provide an opportunity to get a better, new and improved or better drug or series of drugs that can have a major impact in patients who might have very advanced disease. So find out from your doctor about clinical trials. Go to the website of clinicaltrials.gov. Look up CLL trials, ask questions, go to Lymphoma Research Foundation website or the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society website, and figure out from those reputable sites what the options might be. But it's also important to say that there's a lot of other options well beyond what we've talked about here. I alluded to one of them in the immunotherapy discussion I talked about. That's something called CAR T-cell therapy. And we don't really have time to get into it today, but I'd encourage you to explore that, chimeric antigen receptor T-cell therapy. It's a way to take the patient's own T-cells and genetically modify them so that we can trick those T-cells into recognizing the CLL cells. And I should also mention that it's in some cases appropriate to do what we call an allogeneic stem cell transplant. That's for very advanced disease and in the right patients. Most patients don't get that, and most patients don't need that. But that's certainly an option. An allogeneic transplant, meaning using stem cells from a donor, perhaps a sibling, to repopulate bone marrow after some chemotherapy or radiation that changes the patient's own bone marrow, that process actually is essentially the ultimate immunotherapy. It's a way to bring in a donor's immune system to eradicate the CLL. And that's something that we don't do often, but it's something very important to understand as an option for the right patients with advanced disease.
Well, that's excellent. Well, thank you. I really want to thank both Dr. Cagle and Dr. Brown, outstanding speakers. I have to say I want to thank all of our participants. You asked really such really wonderful questions, and we hope that that you'll take those questions also back to your treating healthcare team. And I want to thank all of you who've been listening. I want to remind everyone that this is a one-hour workshop, and in planning a program like this, we recognize that you all have many needs that go far beyond the scope of 1 hour. So I do want to, first of all, for those of you who have not yet had a chance to ask your question, I actually do want to actually let you know how to get your questions that you didn't get to ask answered. First of all, of course, your healthcare team is, of course, a great resource. But in addition to that, we often recommend that people contact the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237 or 1-800-422-6237. But in addition to that, I think that also Dr. Pickle mentioned the Lymphoma Research Foundation, and that information is in all of your materials at 1-800-500-9976, and the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society also all have wonderful call centers for you to get information from. So I would definitely recommend that you contact those centers as well. And for those of you who actually may not have a medical question, but really have a question about just your coping with CLL or with your cancer or with, just the issues that you're confronting, either as a person living with CLL or a family member, you also can contact Cancer Care and speak to one of our oncology social workers. And to do that, you can contact Cancer Care at 1-800-813-4673. And we do have that wide range of services, all of which are free, and it's definitely worth a phone call. And it's also worth a phone call, of course, to the Leukemia Lymphoma Society and the Lymphoma Research Foundation, as well as all of the organizations, or many organizations who partnered on today's call, all of whom offer wonderful services for all of you, so that there's quite a large array of places that you can call. And so that really does feed into the fact that I don't want anyone to leave this call today feeling that you're alone. I want you to know that you're now part of this really world of support services coming both from Cancer Care and from all these other organizations, and we want you to take advantage of them. You don't have to be in a crisis situation to call any of us, and if you are, then do call us, of course, but if you're just feeling like, I need someone to talk to, I'd like to be a part of some type of a support group, I'd like some resources, and we all know about each other's resources, so refer back and forth. We would want to get you to the place that's the most helpful to you. So please, as we conclude the call today, know that you're simply a phone call away from any of us, or for those of you who prefer visiting our websites and logging in your questions or getting connected in that way, you can do that, and that's true for our international participants as well. Now, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I do want to remind all of you that we are doing a program on June 29th on precision medicine and cancer treatment, and some of you may find that quite interesting. It's a concept that you hear about a lot, and it's a program specifically on that topic. So for those of you who might be interested, you'll hear more about it. You'll probably get information about it from us. You probably have already, but nevertheless, just to kind of remind you of that as well. So thank you all, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes today's workshop, and you may all disconnect. Have a great day, everyone.